The following Dharma talk was given by Lawrence Doan Greco in February of 2012. For more information, please visit www.openskyzen.com.
So tonight I want to talk about this koan called life. Everyone knows what a koan is. You've heard the word koan, right? More or less. For example, it's usually a nonsensical question, like what is the sound of one hand clapping? So it's not a kind of question you can answer rationally. It's a kind of question that takes something else, takes some kind of either wisdom or silence, something other than our thinking minds to solve. And throughout most of our days, I mean, how many times are we presented with situations that we can't quite think our way out of? Or we think we're thinking our way out of, but then we make things worse. Or we think we solve a problem, and in so doing, we create another problem, and on and on and on. So this koan study that I'm engaged with, actually Sergio here has the same teacher that I do. So every week I meet with my teacher. We speak for about an hour or so. And we do these very Zen-style koan interviews where he presents a koan, which is like a situation or a case, and then I have to answer. That was the inspiration for this talk. So looking at that and how it relates to our lives is what I wanted to talk about today. Is anyone familiar with the Augustine Burroughs book called Running with Scissors? Have you heard this book? It was also a movie. And I read it, I don't know, about 5 or 6 years ago. And the first chapter is called Something Isn't Right. The first chapter of the book. And he talks about how at a very young age he observed his mother and how unconventional she was. And it's a very unconventional childhood that followed. And I love that title because it reminds me of the first noble truth. So what's another way of wording the first noble truth? Which is what? First noble truth. Suffering. We hear life is suffering. How else do we hear it described? The existence of suffering. So suffering happens. It happens. Dukkha. Right. Interestingly, we do use the word dukkha, suffering, but it's not a direct translation of dukkha, supposedly. It generally means that things feel unsatisfactory, or everything's a little off, less than ideal, or less than convenient. So that can mean a lot of things. It could mean extreme emotional or physical suffering, or it can mean feeling slightly uncomfortable on this cushion right now. So there's a big range of dukkha. A little dukkha, and there's a lot of dukkha. But regardless of that, you know, the suffering we experience, or the discomfort we experience, is largely due to the way we think about our situation, or what we bring to our day-to-day situation. So we have these problems every day. Something comes up, either unexpected or not, something that maybe is a result of our own actions, or something that seems kind of random. It happens at work, or someone says or does something to us, and then we have this situation to deal with. We have this problem, all kinds of problems. I mean, I'm sure we all have a whole bunch of them. And it feels like we're these subjects surrounded by objects, these objects and things swirling around. So I'm over here, and these all these potential problems around me. Co-worker, a spouse, a partner, anything. And most of the time, I would say our problems arise from the fact that we're not clear on three things. We're not clear on the situation, meaning what's really going on here. And two, we're not clear on what's my relationship to this situation. And then three, what am I supposed to do? How do I respond to this situation? So koan practice, as it's been taught to me, was specifically designed to address these three aspects of our lives, or what we consider to be problems, especially the way my teacher's teacher, who was Zen Master Sung San, that was his whole goal of but his form of koan study was to help us figure out a way to deal with the everyday problems of life, to figure out how do we function appropriately in the world, when life seems so baffling so much of the time, right? Something always feels like it's not right. Something's always off, and we don't always know what to do. And thinking our way out of things doesn't always seem to cut it. Doesn't always seem to work. So again, it's about being clear in our situation, our relationship to our situation, and then our function, meaning what do we do? Three things. You know, most of the time we don't see the situation itself. So let's say a problem arises. And what we do is we inject onto it a whole lot of thinking, a whole lot of associations, a whole lot of perceptions or ideas or concepts. Or we think about, you know, whatever this person or situation reminds us of from our past gets put onto it. So there's this constant overlay, like these layers of meaning that we pile onto things. And it obscures what's really going on, and we're not seeing things clearly. This is how we operate a lot of the time. Because we're taught to be rational people. We're taught to be logical. So we end up overdeveloping our brains and not ignoring our hearts completely. My first reminds me of my first job when I was 16 was at a Roy Rogers fast food place. And my main function was to, I don't know if it still goes on anymore. Anyone's been to Roy Rogers? But they had something called the Fixins Bar. Do they still have, have you been to Roy Rogers? Are they anywhere anymore? Has anyone ever heard of them? Am I that old? At rest stop. Oh, yeah, like those kind of things. Yeah, like those kinds of. Yeah, so they used to have them like all over the place, like on Long Island where I'm from. So I used to tend to the Fixins Bar. And the Fixins Bar was, it was like F-I-X-I-N apostrophe, Fixins Bar. And it had, you know, the pickles and the onions and the relish and the mustard. So it's all of these things that got added to the really bad, bad for you food. Really nasty hamburger. So that's why I look at the way we add things to our experience. It reminds me of the Fixins Bar. Like the hamburger's never good enough. It needs ketchup and onions. And then you feel disgusting afterwards once you've eaten it. That's what we do, because we're always adding. You should have seen the way I used to have to dress then. They used to make me wear a red satin shirt with white fringe hanging from the pockets. I'm not kidding. And a big cowboy hat. It's hysterical. From 16 to 18, that's what I had to wear. I don't think they can get anyone to do that anymore. So we throw all these extras on to our experience, and then we feel weighed down. Right? We feel gross, like we ate that disgusting hamburger. So the second noble truth identifies the source of us, of our suffering. How is that? How do we understand the second noble truth? What's that about? What's it saying? So the Buddha gave us this diagnosis. He said, all right, there's suffering. You're always kind of, there's this dukkha thing happening. Then he came up with the cause. What was that? Attachment.
Attachment. Or delusion. Depends on your...
Right, delusion. What else can we...
It's just
right, just the realization that there's a cause to this. There's a reason it exists. Okay, Karen?
Desire for something, someone,
and lack of that. So the desire for something, or the craving for something. Right, so in a lot of ways it could be an attachment to things, people, objects, or status. It could also be an attachment or a craving for things to be other than how they are. It could also mean that we get attached to our thinking. We get attached to our ideas about things or how things ought to be. So there's a lot to it. There's a lot of ways of interpreting it. So it's this attachment to our thoughts that removes us from our moment-to-moment experience. And interestingly, you know, thoughts, I'm going to talk a lot about thinking and thoughts, and I don't want to give the impression that our thoughts are our enemies. They're really not. They're perfectly natural, and they come up all the time. You know, once, when you're living and breathing and you have a brain, you're going to have thoughts. So I just want to offer a little disclaimer that I'm not saying there's something wrong with having thoughts. However, thoughts have this dual nature. So on one hand, they're very natural and they spring from life itself. So just by being alive, our brains produce thoughts. But at the same time, these thoughts cause us to feel disconnected from our experience. Kind of interesting. So we don't experience things as they are. We experience things through the prism of our conception of how they are. There's even been a study that came out last year that suggests most of what we perceive is really memory. That makes sense. So whatever we're perceiving, we're having some memory of what we're experiencing. Like, I don't know, if you look at a red tie, it's not just a red tie. It reminds us of, you know, I don't mind. My father walked out on us wearing a red tie and or whatever. It reminds us of something else. So we're always bringing stuff and piling it on, adding the fixins. So we're, a lot of the time, it's like we're disconnected and confused. There's this a writer and a Zen master named Richard Schrobe who talks about it in terms of we think we're alone when in reality we're all one. Look at even the way it's spelled, A-L-O-N-E, alone, versus all one. We add an L. And that's the reality of our situation, that we all are connected somehow. So the reality of things, the true nature of things, is that all things are interdependent. But we do suffer from this delusion that we're cut off from each other, that we're all these separate, completely unrelated entities bumping up against each other. And that's where we get into problems. So even that realization is somewhere to start. Realization that we're not as separate as we think we are. We're not these solid, unchanging individuals. So having an understanding of that and an understanding that everything is essentially impermanent, right? That's one of the three main qualities of life the Buddha talked about. Things are always changing, constantly changing. But there's something about it that we don't like. It's like we're trying to freeze a river in place, right? Or we're trying to swim upstream all the time. We're trying to either keep things the way they are all the time or go back to the way they used to be. Or we have some hope for how we'd like them to be or some fear as to how we think they're going to turn out. Instead of just kind of going with this flow, going with the flow of life. We're always sort of battling it. And we suffer. So this thinking that we do creates a lot of confusion. This confusion creates a lot of disconnection, a lot of distance. There's a Zen story I like to tell sometimes. It illustrates how our minds work. There's a woman sitting on the side of a road, and she sees this guy on a big wild horse running towards her. And once in a while, the horse will stop in front of her, jump up and down its hind legs, and then run down the other side of the road. And then she sees the guy coming back again on the horse. And finally, she yells at the guy, "Where are you going?" And he goes, "I don't know, ask the horse." Right? But it is funny, but that's like us when we let our minds pull us this way and that. When we let our brains take over and our thoughts take over, we're no better than the guy on the horse. We're just being pulled around. And we don't realize it. It feels perfectly natural. Like we have one thought in our head, and we buy into it. We think it's the most important thing in the world. And then all of a sudden, our emotions change, right? We have this thought, and all of a sudden, fear sets in. Or elation, or optimism, or pessimism, or whatever. And then we respond based on that. Not even realizing it's all just this very insubstantial little thought happening. But we're paying it a lot of attention. You know the game Mad Libs? I used to love Mad Libs. Has anyone here not ever heard of Mad Libs? You've not heard of it? How do we describe Mad Libs? Basically like a set of stories with lots of blanks in them. A few paragraphs long. And it's a game, of course, that you play. And you ask your partner or people around you, all right, give me an adverb. Give me the name of a person, of a male person in the room. Or give me an adjective. And then you fill in all the blanks, and then you read the story aloud to your friends. And it's usually very funny. Right? Kind of outrageous or irrational or ridiculous. And I look at what we do as a big game of Mad Libs. Because we like to fill in the blanks all the time. We're constantly filling in blanks, trying to make some sense out of our situation, instead of just perceiving it and then giving it time. Because not everything can be figured out immediately. But it's our tendency to want to. It doesn't feel good to not know what's going on all the time. It's a little disconcerting. Or to not know where you stand in a relationship. Not know how are you going to pay the rent this month. Or your bills. Or any number of things. So I'm going to tell this little story. If you've heard this story before, a lot of you probably have. If you have, though, I ask you not to come up with the answer right away, because I want people who haven't heard it to give it a chance, because it's a good example of how koan works. So there's this man named Mike, who is the attending physician of a hospital. And he has an 8-year-old son, and one day he decides, you know what, I hardly get to spend time with my son. So he arranges to have 3 days off. He packs up their Jeep, and he takes his son on a camping trip. So on the way to the country, a car crashes into their Jeep, killing Mike, the physician, instantly. But the boy survives. An onlooker gets an ambulance to take the boy to the same hospital where Mike was the physician at. And they wheel the boy into the operating room. The doctor comes out, looks at the boy, and says, "Oh my God, that's my son." How can that be? Now, who doesn't know the answer to this right now? Who's not sure? You're not sure. You're not sure. Just sit with it for a minute. Don't think too hard. Does anyone now think they might know? No. That's not a bad answer. Did you just get it? Oh, the Barbie pin is not working. I love this high-tech mic. Okay. So did you get it?
Yeah.
What do you think? Oh, okay. Interesting. So maybe it was his mother or his other father.
Yeah.
Could be a number of them, right? So could have been either. But isn't it interesting that a lot of us didn't know that right away? Because we have these constructs about what is a physician, usually a male. Interesting, right? That's how a koan works. You know, so these koans that I train in, they're like these tools to point us to our true nature. So sometimes you may have heard the analogy that Zen or Buddhism is like a finger pointing at the moon. So that's the moon, right? But you don't want to get caught up in the finger, because then you won't get what the moon's about. So all these tools we have, right? So all the Dharma, all these Dharmic teachings we have, or these tools like koans, or whatever you do personally, even meditation itself, they're all these fingers pointing at the moon. But we don't want to get stuck on the finger. So when we have problems come up in life, we don't want to fixate too much on the problem itself, because then we end up missing something bigger. We miss out on the wisdom we really have that we can access. So by presenting a student with a koan, a teacher is forcing the student to do something other than think their way through it. Because it doesn't matter how smart you are. It's one thing, reason I love koan practice, that you don't have to be smart. It doesn't help you. In fact, the smarter you are, the worse off you might be. And my father used to, he's a very no-nonsense kind of guy. And I remember once a long time ago, he came back from a business meeting, and one of his colleagues was very intellectual and used to annoy the hell out of him. And he once said about him, he says, "You know, that guy is so smart that he's stupid." But now I get what he meant. I didn't know what he meant then, but he had a good point. That this guy was so in his head all the time, he didn't have any heart, he didn't have any sense, wisdom, common sense. So again, these koans were devised to help us get clear on our situation, our relationship, and our function. And that's kind of, when you think about it, that's all we want, right? When something crazy is going on, we want to know, all right, what's going on? What's my relationship to this situation, whether it's this person screaming in my face, this bill that needs to be paid, or whatever. And then function. What do I do? What am I supposed to do? That's problem solving 101. Is anyone here, well, you do koan practice too. Has anyone else here done koan practice? Or even had like a sampling?
A little bit.
You have?
Yeah,
it is hard.
Because I'm very intellectual, so that's why I like it, because it pushes me completely. I haven't had like formal practice, but I've like played with it, and it's really good practice for me, because it's totally like not how I normally operate.
Do you remember, was there a time, maybe not remember, but that you actually felt like you actually got the right answer, and then what it was like? Or did you not go that far with it?
No.
You didn't go there.
No.
Okay.
Not
That's
yet.
All right. That's all right. No. You just, it sounds like you doubt. That's all right. What is it like when you get the right answer? When Paul tells you, our teacher's name is Paul Lynch. What's the experience like? If you can describe it. It's like emptiness.
It's a good feeling of like empty of the self, you know, compared to when I just like, oh, thank you. You know, and
yeah, you start that little inner dialogue, right?
And when it's not, it's just this like, so natural.
Yeah, there is something natural. Like, I know when I have the right answer to the koan or the question, my initial reaction is, pops into my head, no effort. My first reaction is, that can't be it, it's too simple. It's too obvious, there's no way that's it. Then I give the answer, and he says, correct, and I'm shocked. That's it. And the second, if he asks a question, the second I start doing this, I know I'm not getting it. Right? Even look at, you know that sculpture by Rodin, the thinker? What is his posture like, right? He's like this. He's like crouching over. It's closed, right? He's thinking. And then meditation posture, what do? We all just did this 25 minutes. This is meditation posture, right? It's upright, straightforward, kind of courageous in a way, brave. It's awake. It's willing. Not this. That's a good posture for the toilet bowl. Suzuki Roshi said in one of his books, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, in the mind of the beginner, possibilities are endless. In the mind of the expert, possibilities are few. I love that quote. Many of you probably heard the term beginner's mind. But this book he wrote was Beginner's Mind, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. The teacher who started the tradition in which I study now, Sung San, he called it don't know mind. Having a don't know mind is the key to solving these koans, and I would say the key to dealing with all the complexities of life. But what is a don't know mind? How do you define don't know mind? It even sounds weird, right? Because we want to know things. We like to know things. We like to know stuff.
Don't know. Being open to possibilities.
Mm.
There's more than just the one answer that I can come up with.
So by not knowing, there's more room for possibility. Something you wouldn't have thought of.
I also think of it as like egoless mind. When your ego's not running the show, then you're okay with that kind of spaciousness of, what could pop up, or you know, like she said, openness. When the ego is kind of working overtime, it wants to know, and it's fixated on having the right answer, then your worldview is like really, really limited.
So getting rid of the I and the me and the mind, makes things less narrow
mm-hmm.
and myopic. So it's maybe, so it's less ego-based, it's open, more potential. What else might it be? Don't know mind. I look at it like it's
curious.
You know, curious. Right, having a curiosity rather than a know-it-all mind. Just saying, you know, what is this? Interesting. Even sometimes literally in Zen we ask that question, what is this? Not in a sarcastic way, like, what the hell is this? But just, what is this? Just, okay, this came up. Ah, okay. What's this? Hmm. What am I feeling?
It doesn't fit in my construct that I've made.
Right.
This is
or even choosing not
so
to.
I'm confused because it's like, do we have to have some construct like language or getting up every day and doing certain things to know that we'll feed our children and, you know, the acquisition of knowledge? And so I just, it's like that balancing.
Absolutely,
and even
yes.
Seeing within the balancing.
Right. I would say,
you know,
the vast majority of the thinking we engage in
mm-hmm.
is not so useful, but
mm-hmm.
there is such a thing as strategic thinking. Right? We have to, like when you get up from here, there'll be thinking involved. Wait a minute, what do I do? Do I put the cushion away? How do I exit? Mm-hmm. We do it, yes. Thinking is not always bad. Like I was saying, it's not always the enemy. Getting an education is not bad. But we do need to think strategically. If you're at work and your boss comes over to you, she says, you know, what happened to that report yesterday? Don't just sit there and say, what is this? Lawrence told me to have a don't know mind, so I'm going to just sit in meditation posture and I'll get back to you later. Or if someone's running at you with a bat, just think, you know, I'm going to get the hell out of here. I'm going to run. So that's a good point, and I was going to bring it up too, but I'm glad you mentioned it.
Yeah.
The thinking has its place, of course. But most of the thinking, and if you really pay attention to it, and as you practice more, you become more aware of all the kinds of thinking that goes on throughout the day, kind of useless. I catch myself a lot throughout the day. Even like I'm at the gym, I'm like, I find myself, oh, I'm in that thought loop again. Interesting. All I'm doing is working out. Or I thought I was, but I wasn't paying attention. Don't even know what I was just doing. Or how many times have we had a meal with someone, or even alone, and you don't even know what you just how it tasted? How was that? And you're like, it's fine, I guess. We weren't there, we were up here somewhere. A lot of our thinking disconnects us from what's happening.
Well, I wonder too if the thinking that becomes sort of obsessive is also when we can't solve it, we tend to fixate more.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the ones that are sort of the background, like, oh, I'm going to do this, maybe we pass through it. Whereas, you know, the ones like the koan we can't solve, and then we get obsessive and we see ourselves.
Right.
And we see the voices saying, I'm an idiot, I can't get them through it. And
yeah.
That's the same thing. It's like,
yeah, we inflame the situation.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a good analogy. I mean, sometimes when we fixate on something too much, it's like we're throwing fuel onto the fire instead of just backing off and letting it burn out. So it's not being at war with our thoughts, we're not completely ignoring them, but we're also not indulging them to death. Very tricky. The whole point of meditation practice. What we were doing, more or less, when we sat together. Notice our thoughts, we get caught up in them, oh yes, I'm supposed to breathe. The thoughts come up, oh yeah, I'm supposed to breathe. Sometimes it takes 10 minutes to remember to breathe. 2 seconds, very. But I also look at this don't know mind, I look at it like diving into groundlessness. Diving into groundlessness. That's what I call it. Groundlessness meaning what? The uncertainty, right, of our situation. The changeability of our situation. But groundlessness, it sounds scary because we like to feel like everything is kind of sorted in some kind of order. But life isn't really that way, and that doesn't have to be scary. That's not bad news because that means, you know, what seems like a bad situation could become a good situation and vice versa. And we think this is what we need to be happy, but it turns out, no, actually that won't do it. this will do it. And when we're not too fixated on what we think will make us happy, there's room for what will make us happy. Just having that open mind. And even taking it a step further, having grace within groundlessness. Have a sense of grace. What does grace mean? What would it mean to have grace within groundlessness?
Being free from judgment.
So maybe not judging your experience.
Judging the fact that there is no ground.
All right, or not resenting it, maybe. You mean not resenting or judging? So not judging it.
When I think of grace, I think of just effortless movement.
Mm-hmm. Going with the flow.
Yeah, just being. So what if my house is burning down?
Maybe not in that situation, but I get the analogy. Yeah. So
well,
maybe not struggling.
Right, yeah.
Not fighting against life.
I think that what I mean by judgment, I think, oh, this is struggling.
I also hear the word a lot when I think of grace. I think of surrendering, kind of not in like a Westerners. We think of surrender as like this giving up our power, but it's more like a gentle, like saying yes or just kind of being really open to the fact that you're scared as hell that life is groundless and impermanent, but just really like saying yes to it. Like, okay, here I am. This is it.
Mm-hmm.
So. I'm just going to kind of let it move me instead of let the impermanence kind of move me instead of me trying to like
battle fight it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So almost consenting to our experience.
Yeah, consenting. Like saying, like when you arrive on your seat, for example, you're like saying yes to yourself, to whatever, you know, that experience is. So it's kind of the same thing. Like when I sit to meditate, I'm surrendering for however long I'm going to sit and to be groundless. Because when I'm in my sitting meditation, that's what I experience. You know, it's scary sometimes.
So. Yeah, that's a good point. Because, yeah, meditation is one big part of meditating is just simply witnessing impermanence in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It is witnessing. And it is surrendering. Say, okay, this is what really goes on. So let me sit still long enough to get clear on what really goes on.
Yeah.
Instead of pretending it's not going on and trying to arrange my life in a way that gives me the illusion of security and permanence all the time, which is what we want to do. It's how we were all raised. It's how most of the world operates. But for you, 14 or so people.
Being a mother, you know, and trying to teach your kids, like, how to plan. You know, leave your wallet near the door so you don't forget your metro card.
Right.
You know, and...
Which is,
of course,
very important.
Yeah,
yes.
So it's interesting. The other thing I was thinking about grace, there's a little bit almost of joy in grace.
Mm.
And then I was thinking about humor and how humor and grace are kind of like two sides of a similar thing.
Yeah.
Like when you can have a sense of humor about something, it means an easefulness.
Mm.
And then also humor is very much like a koan, because it's sort of like that moment where you see your nature, and then you look at it again, and you're sort of like, oh,
turning something on its head.
My humanness. Oh, is that funny? I can laugh about it instead of, you know.
Right.
It's sort of like, it's interesting, because humor to me is like the most graceful. When I know I'm laughing, then I know I'm generally walking pretty comfortably. When it's not a cynical.
Yeah. Right. Laughing at someone.
You know,
yeah.
No,
I agree, absolutely.
Laughing,
yeah.
Then I know I'm usually in
think laughter saves us, and I think it is a form of grace.
Mm-hmm.
Humor is a form of grace, absolutely. So in a way, koans are turning some situations on their heads. It's turning logic on its head and asking you to do something else but be logical. And having a sense of humor, because things are kind of ridiculous if you think about it. And the things that happen to us in life are really rather absurd. So at least seeing that and finding the humor in it is absolutely a way to have grace within groundlessness. I agree. It really saves us, I think. Saves us.
I want
a
faith in there, too.
Faith in what?
Faith that the next moment
here will be okay.
Right. It may not be awful. Or a little better. Or manageable.
Yeah.
And that's something you can work with. Mm-hmm. I like that, yeah. But that's the thing with impermanence is that it does imply that, you know what, things will get better. Things will shift or change. Right, or they'll get bad again, but they'll be good again. It's just the nature of things. But we're not shocked. It's funny, sometimes I have these conversations with my mother, and she just goes off on the weather. And she's 77 years old and very healthy, and I'm very grateful for that. But it's as if she just met weather. Like, she doesn't get, oh my, can you believe how it's raining today? Oh my God. Oh, this weather. So cold. Like, well, it's February. It's not that cold. It's kind of funny, though. And then when it's really nice, there are days it's really nice. Like, isn't it nice out today? It's like, yeah, but they say it's going to be raining tomorrow. I'm like, true, but it's nice today. It's warm out. Oh boy. That's when we put the phone down. Just let her talk. So, by noticing our experience without embellishing, right, without adding all the fixins, that's a place to start. To notice it, to be present with it, to not demand or react with an instant answer, a reflexive answer, a defensive answer. The one that's programmed to come out whenever X happens, we do Y. That reflexive brain that we have. That's a way to handle life like a koan, or each problem that arises as a koan. Or to even revisit something, you know, is it a problem? If I don't make it a problem, is it a problem? What does a problem mean? Actually, that's a good question. What is a problem? Are we defining it? What's a problem? Right. Hey, that's a good, yeah, that might sum it up. If something isn't not getting what we want, feels like a problem. Things not going the way we'd like them to, that's a problem.
And not seeing a way to get it
resolved. Or to our liking.
Right.
So not being able to get things, make things to our liking, it's a problem. Big problem. So even, right, changing our perspective of things. What is a problem? What used to seem like a problem to some of us maybe, you know, 5 years ago, now seems like, you know, certain things that used to bother me 5 years ago, now it's roll off my back.
There.
Right. Uh-huh. They're the one. Was it me? Yeah, the word, you heard the word prajna? Prajna Parami. Usually means wisdom. We look at prajna as wisdom, but the etymology of the word means you cut it in half, prajna or prajna. It means before thinking. So wisdom is what happens before our thinking mind takes over. So that's always there. That's already your natural state. So that's the good news. You already have this to start with. So there's no need to try to develop wisdom or get some wisdom or meditate our way to some wisdom. We already have it. All we're trying to do is get in touch with it, trying to access it again. Trying to peel off all the layers of conditioning and habit and thinking from years and years that have obscured that wisdom so that we don't have to be so disconnected from our lives. So that we don't have to be confused with every new issue or problem that we face. So I guess, you know, living this way, it brings about more of a sense of ease and a naturalness. And now again, there are certain times where we do have to respond very quickly to things. You know, we have jobs, we have children, parents. We can't always sit or wait. But even those issues that demand immediate responses over time, we do learn to respond more appropriately through sitting more, through practicing more, by being completely present with what is instead of being at odds with it, by realizing what we have in common with someone as opposed to how different they look or seem or act or sound, how different they seem from us. Yeah, I found some real changes in myself and the way I respond to certain things. Like things that used to set me off. Has anyone here experienced that? Like something that used to always set you off, or you used to have like the stock reaction to something, and then it shifted somehow? You think of something?
Yeah, I'll give you a perfect example. I was recently talking about this. My grandmother used to comment on my weight, like growing up.
Mm.
She's Cuban, and that's like a whole thing. Like,
mm.
It wasn't, but she didn't mean it like in a negative way. She would just always like make a comment, like you're either too fat or you're too skinny. Like there was always some commentary about my body type,
mm.
And it was really interesting because like a few years ago, really when I started practicing, and as I get deeper into my practice, it gets better and better. Like I just notice it. I'm just like, oh, she's like really fixated on my weight, and for her that's like an affectionate thing. Like for her talking, like that's what she feels she needs to comment on because she loves me. But like when I was 15, it would drive me crazy to the point where I didn't even want to see her because
mm-hmm.
I was so self-conscious about my weight at the time, and I was so obsessive
mm-hmm.
about my body that I was just like. But it's funny because even now when I see her, I already know she's gonna do it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like. I almost look forward to her commenting because I'm just like, oh, there
mm.
she goes again. Like, there's my, like, senile grandma talking to me. Wait, and I love her. And
yeah.
What a blessing that I have a grandmother that cares enough to even look at me and say, you're not eating enough. Are you vegetarian?
Mm.
Or, you know, whatever. Like, so, but it was a shift for me because when I was younger, it was so like, what is she saying about me? It's a value judgment, all this stuff. And now I'm just like, doesn't matter. Irrelevant, you know
right.
what I mean? Like the charge just kind of got
it used to seem you would perceive it as hostile,
yeah,
or demeaning,
really,
diminishing.
Yeah, I really had a lot of like beliefs like around
right.
that, and you know, and really now, like, it doesn't have any, like, it doesn't even hurt or have a charge. It's just, like, oh, there
yeah.
that goes again, and it's similar to like my own thought loops,
mm-hmm.
it's the same thing, like, oh, there that goes, like,
right. even just noticing that,
yeah,
right.
So it's kind of funny because I was talking to a friend about that today. Reminded me.
Mm-hmm. Same with Italian families, I can tell you.
Yes.
There's this noticing of weight. And I think it is a form of affection. Like, to say, oh, I remember last time you were heavier, now you're lighter.
Yeah, that's what
and
it
light,
is.
It's just, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not criticism, but
no,
we can perceive it
like,
as criticism.
Yeah.
Like, oh, are you eating enough?
Right.
Well, then you're heavier, are you?
Right, right, right. Like, we make it mean something that my
right.
Like, I would make it mean something that my grandma would say. Oh, you're heavier or you're skinnier. And I'd be like, well, what is she trying to say? Like, what, is she saying
right.
I'm like worse off? You know, like,
yeah. All, the, yeah, all the fixins you were putting
exactly,
on there.
All the fixins.
On the burger or the veggie burger.
Now I prefer minimal fixins to none, if possible.
Or just the burger or the
yeah.
veggie burger. We're vegetarian. So I guess, in a nutshell, putting the story down. Not adding on all the fixes is a good place to start. Trying to have this don't know mind, where there's more room for potential, possibility, and just admitting sometimes we really don't know. There are things we just don't know. Having curiosity, openness, and then just doing what needs to be done, responding appropriately. Don't know mine too. It's like a blank canvas. Or you open a Word document on your computer and you haven't started writing yet. That's a don't know mine. Like anything can happen. There's all these possibilities. Limitless possibilities. And the more stuffed we are with ideas, the less room we have something more appropriate to happen. Well, thank you. This was, I really enjoyed talking with you all. Good to see you all again.